So today, we usually do the nose, and that's a weekly cultural roundtable with a panel. And I don't know, I'm just back from a public radio conference where we've been talking a little bit about innovation and the future. And so what we're doing right now is just taking kind of a hiatus from the nose while we think a little bit more about how we do it, whether we could do it better. So we're going to do a different kind of cultural show today. We're going to talk about the buzz around the movie Crazy Rich Asians. We're going to talk about whether baseball is making some mistakes that could lead to its demise as a major league sport. And we'll do some endorsements, but not in the usual way. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after this news. So welcome to this episode of, it's not exactly the nose, we're doing something a little bit different today, but let me begin by saying a different thing, which is, you know, this is kind of a year in which after several years of bemoaning and legitimately bewailing the lack of representation, some really important thrusts towards representation in movies have taken place. I guess you could sort of even backdate that to at least Get Out and Wonder Woman last year. But these two huge tentpoles of representation, Black Panther and now Crazy Rich Asians, are very much a part of an even larger discussion. So I just, even before I introduce the guest on this, I want to tell you, A, that in the second segment, we're going to have a conversation, which we would never do on the nose, about whether baseball is kind of currently devouring itself, like, you know, the worm Ouroboros, whether there's problems with baseball, even in an exciting season, that may spell not doom, but certainly a decline for it. We'll explain that all Major League Baseball and kids playing baseball in the park, I think we'll be fine. And then towards the end, you know, we usually do these recommendations and endorsements with our panel. Well, we didn't do a panel today, so the producers of WNPR are making their endorsements. I'm really excited about that. Let me say one more thing before I bring aboard Karen K. Ho, and that is this. You know, I mean, I'm a white guy. You might have noticed over the years, I'm a white guy. And as a result, although I have raised a Latino son to the age of 28, so for 28 years, in that way, I sort of get what it's like to go to all kinds of genre shows and just not see oneself, you know, to go to rom-coms and not see oneself, to go to comic book movies and not see oneself. It's something that starts earlier. It starts when you're trying, well, at least, I don't know, 28 years ago, I can tell you it started when you're looking around for children's books that had any Mexican kids in them. You know, that living in America, this fabled melting pot, there's an awful lot of siloing that goes on and also just a lot of sort of latency that goes on. There's this kind of latent assumption that, you know, that most people will be white in culture and that often people of other ethnicities have these very kind of specific kinds of roles, you know, as best friends or comic relief or something like that. And, you know, that's not an absolutely unflinching problem. We can all point to ways in which, you know, it began to diminish. But it's rare. And the thing that makes Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, I think, worth talking about, you know, a little bit in synchronous orbit, is that it's rare to see movies where, you know, white people don't really have any function, which, you know, and that's kind of a relief. And I it's an exciting time. And so Crazy Rich Asians, as everybody probably knows right now, is many things. It's getting good reviews. It is a box office hit. It is fulfilling all of the expectations that were heaped on it. And those were many, many expectations. And here to talk much more knowledgeably than my babbling is Karen K. Ho, a business, culture, and media reporter. She wrote the Time magazine. August 27th, cover story, Crazy Rich Asians is going to change Hollywood. It's about time. It's on the cover of Time, so there you go. She's joining us via Skype. Karen K. Ho, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So let's maybe start with the expectations. This is one of these movies that really, you know, ran out into the marketplace bearing, like Atlas, bearing a globe on its back. Maybe you can say a little bit more about how much was built up around this movie.
Everything was built up around this movie. I think there's expectation regarding everything from casting to how accurately it would represent Singaporean and strange Chinese culture to the level of costumes and set design, you know, that it had to, there were expectations that it had to match, if not exceed, The Devil Wears Prada because of the level of wealth that was indicated simply in the title. And so, you know, and the way that we consume media now is that people are rewatching, or, you know, they're taking screenshots, and, you know, people are consuming media in a way that really rewards a level of detail, but that also puts an additional amount of pressure for the creative people behind the scenes to sort of reward those really diehard fans in a way that I think is a very new and modern thing. But that, you know, that takes a lot of money, or it takes a lot of time if you have a very small budget, which for a movie like this, actually, you know, they did a lot of stuff with, they pulled a lot of strings in order to make it look much richer than the budget actually gave it for.
Right. It doesn't look like anything was done on the cheap in this movie. And so, and of course, that's necessary. It's right there in the title. Just to sort of let's talk about the precipitating event of this plot. We are introduced to Nick, who's kind of a dreamy Nick Young, a kind of dreamy New York based, as we know him anyway, boyfriend of the wonderful Rachel. He is getting married to he's going to be the best man at the wedding of his best friend, who's a really great guy because his name is Colin. So let's hear a little bit about that.
Singapore for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family? My Ama? I meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Picklin?
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
Aww.
All right. And thus the drums begin beating and the plot begins to unfold. Karen, we should maybe even say a little bit more than I have said about how successful this movie is, right? Box office wise and all the ways in which we can even do metrics for critical appraisal. It's hitting all the required marks, right?
Yeah, it's really important that it had a couple of key notable things, which is that its opening period was stretched from 3 days to 5. And so there are two markers regarding more opportunities for people to go out the first week and sort of literally vote with their dollars, you know, get out of the house, book a babysitter, and go to the theater and watch it with their friends and family members. And, you know, so those numbers, I think it was around 24 million just for the 3 day count and more than $34 million for the 5 days, you know, in Canada and the United States. And those numbers are really important because the romantic comedies have not performed very well in the last 3 years. And even especially going back to the last 5 years, you know, in terms of making more than $30 million. And so the fact that it was able to have a radically different looking cast in a genre that has not done well at the box office for the last few years and, you know, had to compete with big franchises starring superheroes and action films. And also the fact that, you know, historically we've seen a lot of movie sales decline as streaming has become much more popular with Netflix and Amazon. So it takes a lot more for people to get out of the house and just see a movie, period. And, you know, even MoviePass has not done super great lately. So there are all these factors saying these were the challenges to get people out to the theaters. And then when we got those numbers, you know, I think it was something around 40% of the audience was Asians and Asian Americans. And that is a dramatically different audience than most of the time when you have all those other movies. I think it's around 10 or 15% at most. And so people were really flocking to the movies in a way that that represented a dramatically different demographic than prior seasons before. And so all of those counts actually said, you know, there was a business case for saying, if you keep doing this, people will keep coming out and spending real money going to this movie.
So, as I hinted at the beginning, I might not be the target audience for this movie. I'm a 63-year-old white guy. But I'm not really much of a rom-com audience. Although, here in my dotage, I'm emotionally promiscuous. So it was very easy to get me sniffling at the end. And I was sniffling the way I'm supposed to be sniffling at the end of this rom-com. But there was a little bit of me, and this is the point of struggle, I think. There's a little bit of me that was sniffling going, this is so wonderful. But these people are like one percenters of one percenters of one percenters of 1%. These are the people who are monopolizing all the world's resources. Why am I getting sentimental about them? And I don't know. I mean, can you address that part a little bit? I mean, this really, you know, this isn't even, I mean, I have a problem with all those Nancy Myers movies where like everybody, you know, is super rich. And I mean, there's no such thing apparently as a romantic poor person or anything like that. In this movie, the poor, dirty little ragamuffin is an economics professor at NYU, a position to which many people in America would probably aspire. So I don't know. Like, talk a little bit about that part of this, the way it is a Valentine, a little bit anyway, to a certain kind of excess.
I think we've had so many movies about romantic comedies that were peons to excess. Mm-hmm. And I think inherently it was still about a fantasy, which is just like, you know, Rachel has this great close friend from college who's rich. You know, she's part of the nouveau riche developer class and, you know, is able to fund her makeover and, you know, the wardrobe that she needs to impress her new family. And to your point, I think the thing is that has never stopped romantic comedies in the past, mm-hmm. whether it be Nancy Myers, whether it be, you know, Made in Manhattan. It's like, this is definitely not the first film to glorify wealth or to warn about it, you know, like Great Gatsby or Titanic. All of these films are about super rich people. And to your point, I think it's Eleanor is actually a great warning about the perils of being responsible and tasked with taking care of that much wealth. She has to give up a lot of her life and what she wants and her career and her education in order to take care of her family and the families that depend on her and her family's corporation. So I think that is actually a really interesting note that is easy to lose when we're discussing this, which is the perils of being tasked with taking care of this wealth and also the feeling of you have to look a certain way and you have to continue to feel that fulfillment. I mean, Astrid is a subplot character in this film, and she talks about having all the money in the world and still having a deeply unfulfilled home life. And it causes enormous strain with her relationship with her husband, who did not come from the same kind of financial background. So if you really think about it, and you know, a lot of people have written a lot of essays about this, there is a lot of wealth on display for sure. And, you know, the glamour of an enormously opulent wedding and bachelor party and several parties in the film. But I think there are definitely attempts to display those real costs for what happens when you are tasked with maintaining that kind of lifestyle and what it can do to a family when that is prioritized above all else.
Right. I just to back up, Eleanor is the character played by Michelle Yeoh. She is kind of one rung down from mater familias of this wealthy family. She is the chilly mother of the male romantic lead here. And Michelle Yeoh is really terrific in this role. I do want to say, just for the record, that, you know, I mean, The Great Gatsby, well, first of all, we'll go back to, I mean, Titanic is very much a movie about sort of class differences and you know, who lives down in steerage and stuff like that. Great Gatsby and Citizen Kane and movies like that were, to my way of thinking, cautionary tales about what happens to you when you get rich. You know, it's lonely, it's isolating, it can cause you to confuse your own wealth with your own real personal goals. And this movie explores that. It kind of probes at that possibility. But somebody, we don't want to do any spoilers, somebody makes a choice for love anyway. So, I mean, maybe that's sort of what you're saying too, is that it does somewhere in there begin to reprioritize some of those things that Nick has inherited just by dint of who he's born to be in his family.
And they joke about that, right? The fact that he very much rejects the money that he comes from. You know, he takes her Netflix password. You know, he steals bits of her dessert when they go out on dates. And I think that's a really interesting thing about the layers of this film. And I mean, there are legitimate criticisms about there needs to be many more stories about Asians and Asian Americans that portray a variety of skin tones and educational backgrounds and income levels. But the fact of the matter is that it's a lot of responsibility and an impossible burden to task this one film with trying to cram in all of these anticipated criticisms regarding things like class and wealth, you know, and ultimately because it was based on a book, and the book was much more satirical and detail laden because it had the it had the advantage of being 500 pages.
Right. And could explore also some ways in which Singapore and mainland China nouveau riche size each other up. That's just sort of a thing that was not going to make it probably into this movie. Just would be hard to do, right?
There is only so much you can cram, right, I think, into a 2-hour film. Yeah. and that is a real issue that Kevin Kwan told me when I was doing the research and interviewing him for this Time feature, which is just, I think, even in terms of, there's always going to be compromises made when you're adapting, a very detail-rich book to the screen, and also trying to make it still accessible on a global stage in the way that they wanted it to when they turned down the Netflix deal.
Right. And, you know, to the extent that it is at times a critique on wealth and excess, maybe we can hear a little bit of that. This is a scene from one of the incredibly lavish parties. I think it's one of the earlier lavish parties. You're going to hear Rachel. She, once again, is played by Constance Wu, who we're going to talk about in just a second, and who is the ingenue, the Cinderella thrust into all this. And you're going to hear, in particular, a character named Oliver, one of several sources of comic relief. He is, I think he calls himself the rainbow sheep of the family. He's pretty obviously a gay member of this incredibly dominant Singaporean family. And so here they are at the party.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Oh, I know.
Rachel. I heard you thought Alma was the cook.
On the bright side, you're the talk of the party. People like your dress.
Oh, I did that.
Oh.
I know.
Such a chic 70s goddess.
So, Oliver, are you a cousin too?
Well, I'm one of the poorer relations. The rainbow sheep of the family. But I make myself useful. Whatever the youngs want, I procure. Golden koi fish, Hongwali furniture, a rare Cambodian gong.
Why would they want to buy a rare Cambodian gong?
Because they can.
So there are moments like this, and moments that have an even more piercing gaze, Karen, than this, that look at that kind of consumption, that starts to take place because it can, becomes kind of a self-licking ice cream cone. There are times where the movie really does sort of look at that and say, there's a road to hell that these people are on, and they just don't know it.
I mean, you know, it just becomes an extreme game of keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like, there's an entire scene about all the matriarchs gathering together and, under the guise of a Bible study, but it's all about what are they wearing, you know, what are their children doing, and what is the gossip that is flitting around all of their phones. And I think that's a really, I think it's something that is discussed about among white Hollywood stars in the way that we see it in the gossip pages or in tabloids. But I think it's a much bigger problem than people realize on a global scale. And why wouldn't not affect the super rich in Asia as well, in terms of the ways in which they feel the need to impress others and also just prove to themselves that they are enormously successful and that anything they want, they can have immediately.
Let's talk a little bit about Constance Wu, if there's going to be a breakout star. Well, she already is the breakout star. She already is a breakout star from this this movie. She's also in the show. She's the star of the show, Fresh Off the Boat, a network comedy with Asian American leads. Tell us a little bit. You had some time to get to know her. Tell us a little bit more about who she is and what's happening to her as the result of all this.
I mean, she's an incredible person. I spent about 3 hours with her, you know, walking walking around a reservoir in Los Angeles. And the thing that really strikes me is that she feels the actual physical weight of having the pressure of doing the first show, you know, in 20 years that had an all Asian cast for major network television. And then, so she had gone through every single question about diversity and the burden of representation for 5 years, right? Her show has just made syndication status, which means many more people will be able to see it into the future. But also it represents a very specific type of Asian American experience, which is what is it like for a family to struggle to immigrate to a part of the United States, grow up in the 90s, and, you know, really establish their own sense of identity amidst classic parts of American culture, like going to shop at Costco. She's enormously funny, really sensitive and observant. And I think she carries the weight of changing an industry in a way that I think is really extraordinary. And it did not surprise me at all when she told me about having panic attacks on a regular basis before the start of this film, because I think she has been very brave and outspoken about the weaknesses in the industry and how she is actively trying to, you know, increase opportunities and change it for the better. But she's also, you know, one person. And I think it's really, really hard to constantly do that for years and not have it physically affect you both emotionally and personally.
I mean, I do want to say, I think she's got, and this whole business of carrying any rom-com, particularly a rom-com with expectations and money and stuff like that attached to it, there are certain people who can do it, and it's an unusual skill set. And I think she's got really tremendous comic chops when she needs them. But she also has the ability to kind of sell her emotional state to the audience and get the audience to collaborate with her on her emotional state. I mean, it's one of the reasons that the other people you could name. And I would also add, she's not intimidating. You know, I mean, the reason that Sandra Bullock is, I think, good at this too, is that we know people who look and talk and act like Sandra Bullock. We don't know so many people who look like Anne Hathaway. And I think Wu has this obvious beauty to her. And certainly when she's all gotten up very specially for the wedding she has to attend, she's absolutely stellar and stunning. But she's also, you know, I don't know, the overworked cliche, I guess, is the girl next door. And I think she kind of has that.
Oh, I think so too. I mean, the thing that's amazing is it took a long time for her to be seen as even the possibility of a girl next door, because so often the girl next door has just not looked like her for such a long time, right? Like, this is literally her first studio film, and she's the lead, and she's on all the billboards, and she's the number one bill. And I think that's extraordinary. And it's also, but she has been training for an opportunity like this her entire life, right? Like, she had been doing lots of great comedic work on Fresh Off the Boat, and she has classically been trained in theater, and so she was ready for this opportunity. I just think it's just interesting that, you know, for the first time, it was she got to be the heroine, and someone like her got to be the heroine. And it's just like, it always makes me wonder. And, you know, it took a lot of things for this to happen. There were many producers who asked that Rachel be recast as a white girl, and so even the mindset of like, this could be real, in many people's minds, wasn't a possibility for a long time. And until the creative talent like John M. Chu and Kevin Kwan really insisted that this was going to happen and this was not negotiable.
We're running out of time a little bit, Karen Cahoe, but I do want to pause and say, I think there's another breakout star here. I'd already seen Ocean's 8, which I found a little bit snoozy, but every once in a while, this person would pop up on the screen who I did not know about and had not recognized, and the movie would suddenly be a lot less snoozy. And that's Awkwafina. In here, she plays huge amounts of comic relief and just... It's almost for a sidekick role, it's kind of a tour de force just in the number of little things she manages to pull off and the little comic style she manages to evoke. I don't know. I'm seeing a very rich future for Awkwafina. I mean, obviously, she already had an established hip-hop career and stuff like that, too.
I mean, her hip-hop career is still it was seen as very niche. And in the early stages, it was mostly an online viral hit with things like My Vag and all these other, you know, really acerbic songs. It's going to be really interesting. There's been criticism about the accent that she often uses in films, mm-hmm. but her timing is impeccable. And it's going to be really interesting to see her rely on different skills and what happens when she stops using that particular hip-hop inflected accent or known as a black scent, because I think it might enable her to actually do much a wider amount of work and also not alienate a really important segment of the movie going public, which is the black and African-American community, because I think she has, you know, great comedic timing. She just needs to be much more of herself without relying on that sort of trope. And I think it's going to be really interesting what the next stage of her career is, because she's already scheduled to be in several more films.
Right. I think the other thing worth mentioning about her is, I mean, the great comedic performers, whether we're talking about Katharine Hepburn or Charlie Chaplin, could really move in interesting ways. This young woman, whether she's playing a street hustling pickpocket in Ocean's 8 or this, you know, zany sidekick here, she's in motion all the time, and she's in a very interesting kind of motion. She can use her body for comic effect, and that's something that I don't think you can easily teach. So yeah, there's the accent question, but I just want to see. I like watching her walk up a flight of stairs. She's manages to make that funny somehow. Well, Karen Cahoe, this is so much fun to talk to you, and I'm fresh out of the movie, so I hope I wasn't too scatterbrained. But definitely read Karen Cahoe's Time magazine cover story, "Crazy Rich Asians is Going to Change Hollywood." It's about time. And we're going to come back. We're going to talk about baseball, but hopefully not in a way that will frighten away you people who don't do the sportsy thing. The sportsing? Is that what it's called? All right. We are indeed back. It's Festivus season in baseball. It's actually always Festivus season in baseball in the sense that Festivus includes the tradition of the airing of grievances. People are always airing grievances about baseball. What's wrong with baseball? Well, let's talk about what's wrong, theoretically, putatively wrong with baseball right now. Scott Miller is National Major League Baseball columnist for Bleacher Report and Turner Sports. He's the co-author with Bob Tewksbury of 90% Mental, an all-star player turned mental skills coach, reveals the hidden game of baseball. You know, I began the last segment by saying, I'm a white guy, so in many respects, I probably don't get everything about representation in movies. I would now like to say that in terms of not getting everything about what's wrong with baseball in 2018, I'm a Red Sox fan. I think baseball's going great, but maybe not everybody does. And so, Scott Miller, tell us a little bit more about this. There is some drop in attendance, and there is some of the old timers looking at the game now say it's all strikeouts and home runs and not all that really cool stuff in the middle. How much of that is legitimate?
Hi, Colin. Nice to be with you. And I think a lot of it's legitimate. I mean, let me start by saying the place I'm coming from is not to take down baseball. I've covered baseball for close to 30 years. And I think it's by far the best game out there, even in this age of all or nothing, home run or strikeouts. Baseball's always been a thinking man's game. It's a summer game. My favorite game by far. That said, yeah, the game goes through cycles, and the cycle we're in right now is, for various reasons, small ballparks. A lot of people think the ball's been juiced over the last few years. Especially last year. So we've reached this point where also analytics-minded front offices have analyzed things, and there's an emphasis now on hitting the ball over the fence. And to the tune of it's a game where about a third of the time the ball's not put in play this year, because 31.6% of at-bats end in strikeouts, walks, or hit batters. And a good percentage of runs scored now, about 35% come on home runs. And since Elias Sports Bureau, the official statistician of baseball, started tracking strikeouts in both leagues way back in 1913, there's only been six seasons in which over 30% of runs come from home runs, and in which strikeouts, walks, and home runs account for more than 30% of the number. And all six of those seasons have come since 2012.
There's a couple of things that appear to be part of this conversation. One of them turns up in everything that you just said, and then one of them doesn't. Let's start with the one that does. I mean, anybody who watches baseball these days knows that pitchers are throwing the ball with what Dennis Eckersley calls variously hump or gas or cheese or, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's the 100-mile-an-hour fastball is no longer the freak show that it used to be, and everybody seems to be throwing up around 93 or 94, and people sometimes are criticized for that. He's only hitting 93 or 94 on the right. speed gun. So how big an issue is that? How big a part of that conversation is that?
Well, there's no question that has contributed to this to the record-setting number of strikeouts that we're seeing now. In fact, the last several years, the last 5 or 6 years in a row, baseball has broken its own strikeout record. That number keeps going up. And this year, by the way, also, this could be the first year in baseball history in which there are more strikeouts than hits overall. In April, we had the first month in baseball history where there were more strikeouts than hits. No question. As you say, Mr. Eckersley, great commentator, analyst, by the way, on Red Sox broadcast, Hall of Famer. Call it gas, call it hump, call it cheese, whatever. There's no question pitchers are throwing harder than ever. And that contributes to the strikeouts. Not just the speed, though, because as it's been said before, a major league hitter could time a speeding bullet if he sees it enough. I mean, these guys can get around on fastballs. The problem is, as velocities increased, it's also the breaking balls, because most hitters can even hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, but when a pitcher amps it up that high, then he drops in a breaking ball of, say, 89 miles an hour. That's where it becomes so difficult for hitters, because it's all about changing speeds. And when you push the top end of the ceiling up to 100 miles an hour, then you drop in something 80 miles an hour. That's where it becomes so difficult.
Although, once again, a changeup is for people who don't follow baseball, a pitch that the pitcher releases with a kind of mimicry of what would typically be his very fast pitch. Instead, it's much slower. Although, once again, this year we are hearing about changeups that are 91, 92 miles per hour, which used to be the speed of a fastball. The changeup used to be much slower. So everything is sort of being changed around that way. Let me ask you about another part of this, and this doesn't address the balls in play, the not enough balls in play issue that you've been talking about and writing about. But to me, it's actually the most irksome thing. There are many times now when I'm watching a baseball game and I see a hitter lash what I think is going to be what Roy Blunt Jr. once called a piquant single, a perfect single sailing up the middle of the field, way right out into center field, and it's caught by some guy standing behind second base. I see a lot of balls that look like they're going to be very satisfying hits that are caught because there are these metrics-driven shifts where by really it's just crunching the numbers of where each hitter hits each kind of pitch, the infielders have cards where they know exactly where to stand. I find that incredibly boring.
Yeah, and that definitely plays into it too. And the major league batting average this year is .248. It's the lowest batting average since 1972. And, even people as high up as Commissioner Rob Manfred are worried about this, the lack of balls put in play. And shifts, no question, have contributed to sabotaging offenses. And, many of the analytics-minded people say, this is a smart way to play. And Manfred's hinted at outlawing the shifts, and the analytics-minded people say, just because we figured something out, you shouldn't outlaw it. One of the ways to change the shift, by the way, if you legislate, if you're in Commissioner Manfred's shoes, one way is that has been suggested would be to draw an imaginary line from home plate through second base all the way into center field. In other words, up the middle of the diamond, and say, okay, you can deploy two infielders on one side of that line, two on the other. You can put them wherever you want, but you can't move that third infielder over, for example, between first and second base. Now, there are others who shudder at the thought of legislating something like
that. Yeah, I mean, to me, that sounds like the Iowa caucuses or something. I don't want that.
Right.
I'm sort of surprised, Scott, that hitters don't simply develop more skills. Why aren't there more people in spring training working on, you know, there's so many of these shifts where an idiot, I could probably bunt on some of these shifts,
yeah.
You know, or just learn to spray the ball around the way Matty Alou used to do. You know, I mean, the more that you do that, the harder you are to program for. It just seems like the solution is for the hitters to do stuff that seems glaringly obvious to some idiot watching TV like me.
Well, Colin, I totally agree with you. In fact, after this piece ran on Bleacher Report this week, the very next day, you know, I woke up to a text from a manager. I don't have his permission to share, so I'm not going to say who, but a text from a prominent manager in the majors that said, among other things, he said, and he's like what kind of leans toward what you just said. He doesn't favor legislation. He thinks the change needs to be organic. He says the only recourse is to have hitters that hitters have is getting back to old hitting techniques, using the entire field, choking up, making adaptations into the at-bat, things like that, shortening your swing with two strikes. And that is where I hope the game goes next. I think organizations had better do a better job of teaching their hitters, and hitters better do a better job of developing and learning. We used to hear so much about use the whole field. George Brett, the Hall of Famer, told me for this story. He said, if they would have shifted me back in 1980, I would have hit 600. Now, granted, not everybody wields his bat like a magic wand, like George Brett did, like Tony Gwynn once did. Not everybody has that skill set, but far more hitters have the capability of using the whole field than we're seeing. Now, the analytics-minded people or in organizations, Jason Worth, the former Philly, was quoted recently saying that organizations are telling hitters, no, don't drop down bunts, don't go the other way. We want you to hit over the shift. In other words, try to hit home runs. Well, if you're David Ortiz, that works pretty well. But for many other hitters that are shifted on, you know, they can't hit home runs on command, although they're trying, and some are doing it and some aren't. And that's why the batting averages are going down. So that's really the crux of the shift debate is, should Commissioner Rob Manfred legislate something, or our team's going to be able to figure out ways to start beating the shift by having their hitters use the whole field.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Williams was one of the early people to be shifted on, and he refused to adjust his style at all. And it worked fine, as you're saying. It works fine for Ted Williams.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But everybody
granted,
else,
we all understand not everybody's Ted Williams or George Brett or Tony Gwynn, but that doesn't mean everybody has to be helpless.
No, and it's, you know, there's this phrase that exists much more in other sports, make them pay. So if they fill the box up to try to stop Walter Payton's run, you throw. You make them pay for the fact that they got too many linebackers packed up towards the line of scrimmage. If you press too much in the backcourt, you know, make them pay. Lob it down to the other end of the court. And it seems to me baseball hitters have to get into the make them pay. You have nobody at third base right now? Nobody? I'm going to make you pay for that.
Right. And I mean, we've heard anybody that's watched baseball from an avid fan to a casual fan has probably heard it's a game of adjustments. You know, the constant season change. The first time you see a pitcher, he may try to work the hitter this way. The second time, if he got the hitter out, well, the hitter better figure out, how did he get me out the first time? I'm going to have to adjust to what the pitcher's doing and take away what he's doing the second time. And that's what, to your point, Colin. I mean, if the defense is shifting here, do this and make an adjustment. And as you say, make them pay or make them come out of their defensive alignment the next time they
right.
face
you. Either that or, of course, everybody will be like the Tampa Bay Rays and never let you see a pitcher twice. We have to stop there. Scott Miller, National Major League Baseball columnist for Bleacher Report and Turner Sports, thank you so much for doing this segment with us. When we come back, a very, very unusual, but I'm told sublime set of endorsements. So once again, just a reminder, we ordinarily do the nose today with a panel. There's usually three people in the studio with me when we get to this point. First of all, you hear some credits from Kion Wolf. She's not here today. Betsy Kaplan's running the board in her place. And Jonathan McPants is the person who produced this show. He wants credit for the fact that the outro music in the last segment was a minor key version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And also that he had compiled a very lovely clip of Aaron Judge talking about all of his strikeouts, and we just didn't have time to use it. All right, so what I suggested was that all the producers, instead of the panel, because there is no panel, make some endorsements, some recommendations. And so we're just going to kind of go alphabetically. We've got the producers of Where We Live in addition to my producers. And so let's start with Carmen Baskoff from Where We Live.
All right, so I would like to endorse the New Haven Free Public Library. I went there a couple weeks ago to find a spot with air conditioning to do some work, and I found out that the Public Library in New Haven has this new innovation center, which has all of these cool tools that are open to anyone with a library card. You just have to get some training on it. So they have like a 3D printer. I'm really excited. They have a laser cutter, which I would love to learn how to use. Sewing machines, vinyl cutters. I think all their computers have like the Adobe Creative Suite on them. And again, that's accessible to everyone with a library card. I think the materials are provided for free too. So I haven't done my training yet, but I'm hoping to spend a lot more time at my local library.
All right. That was the amazing Carmen Baskoff of Where We Live. I don't know how to even comment on that because like I don't know what a laser cutter is, for example. Anyway, let's keep moving. Also from Where We Live, producing Wunderkind, Lydia Brown.
I would like to endorse Weir Farm in southwestern Connecticut. This is a 68-acre National Historic Site, which is replete with beautiful gardens and trails. It also features the former home and studio of American Impressionist painter Julian Alden Weir. My boyfriend and I recently took a free tour of the artist's home and then enjoyed a nice stroll around a nearby pond. I remember it was raining, but we still had a lovely time. We even witnessed a few visitors taking advantage of the free watercolor supplies that were available at the visitor center. So once again, Weir Farm, I highly recommend it. To learn more, visit nps.gov and type Weir Farm into the search box.
And I might add, Weir is spelled W-E-I-R, that kind of Weir. All right, now we're moving on to producers from, actually, only one of the actual regular originating producers of the show contributed to this, but because Josh is not available right now, and I don't know why Pants decided not to, but here's our senior producer, Betsy Kaplan, with what she likes.
I'm endorsing two tools, the Zip-It Bath & Sink Hair Snare and the Brix Jar Key. So Zip-It is a 20-inch long, very skinny plastic tool. It's flexible, and it feels kind of flimsy in your hand, but it's not. The sides are lined top to bottom with symmetrically spaced barbs that point upward, so it's sort of like thorns on a rose bush. You stick it straight down the drain and slowly lift it up. Whatever's down there will either break apart or get stuck on the barbs as you pull it out. It's way more effective than the asthma-inducing drain cleaners that we used to use. I wasn't planning to find it. I was at Home Depot with Keith. He was looking at something else, and I happened to stumble upon this great tool, and it cost $2.50. The Brix Jar Key is the plastic jar opener that releases the vacuum seal on screw-top lids that are hard to open. It sort of looks and works like a bottle opener, but instead of removing a bottle cap, say, it just breaks the seal. You can hear it pop, which I seem to like for some reason. And it doesn't mess up the threads, so you can screw the lid back on if you don't use the whole bottle. I injured my right thumb a few years ago, and it's never regained full strength, so I have trouble twisting off screw-top lids. The same thing happened to my mother. When she was younger, she broke her thumb, and she never regained her strength. So before I found the jar key, I used to use an old trick that my mother used. She would roll a jar across the floor with her foot until the seal loosened. I don't know why this works, but it does. Anyways, the jar key costs $5 and comes in 5 colors. Mine is yellow. It's all they had.
All right, so I don't want you to think that the staff of Where We Live goes on these romantic walks around, lakes that are associated with painters, and we just fish gunk out of our drains, because that's not true. We lead a rich and fulfilling life. But anyway, you'll probably want both of those products, so we have to make sure that all this stuff is up on the website, WNPR/Colin. You can go there, look for today's episode, and we'll certainly tell you how to get the thing where Betsy Kaplan fishes gunk out of the drain. Keith is her husband, by the way. All right, so let's move on to Carlos Mejia. Carlos is our guru of all things technical. I'm looking up his actual title. It's a digital producer at Connecticut Public Radio. What's Carlos up to?
If you or someone you know is in need of a new barber, then I highly recommend Frank's on West in Bristol, Connecticut. Owned and operated by Frank West, Frank is your friendly neighborhood barber. Located conveniently on West Street. You get it? Frank West on West Street. Frank only takes appointments because he's running the business completely on his own, but he takes complaints really well. Visit franksonwestllc.com to book an appointment, or visit the shop on Instagram as franksonwestllc and tell him the nose sent you.
Before we go to the nose, I'm sure that's going to make Frank's day. But I have to say that I need a haircut really badly right now. And one thing that some people know about me anyway is that I, A, have no barber. We're going to get to Kion Wolf's endorsement in just a second. But I have no fixed barber here in Connecticut. I haven't for a long, long time. I used to go to a guy named Mr. Picard on Trumbull Street in Hartford, but he's retired a long time ago. And I just haven't really formed a relationship with anybody, with any barber. I need a haircut right now, and I don't know what to do. I was going to get one in Austin, Texas, where I've been for the previous 4 days. It's so hot in Austin, Texas, you can't go anywhere. God forbid you should go like walking around looking for a barbershop. You would die. You would just be found on the street or something. So I couldn't possibly do that. Anyway, that does. So I should say I've gotten my hair cut in Souillac, France, twice in Montreal, in Belfast, Northern Ireland, I don't know, like lots of places that aren't here, basically, San Francisco, and maybe I'll have to go to exotic Bristol. I got to do something about this hair. All right. Finally, our technical producer, Kion Wolf. Let's see what she's up to.
My endorsement is the Seeing White podcast. It's from the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and it's hosted by John Bewin and sort of co-hosted by Chenjerai Komanika. And it's about, well, being white. And when I first heard about it, it was sort of a hard sell. Why would I be interested in knowing more about whiteness? But it has vastly broadened my understanding about race and how race was conceived of and taught and understood and totally misunderstood. Stuff I never even thought about or that I thought I understood, but I definitely, definitely don't. Every episode's a little bit different in terms of length. Sometimes they're 13 minutes, sometimes they're 48 minutes. There are 14 episodes in this whole series, Seeing White. And if you're only going to listen to one, listen to episode 4. The name of that episode is On Crazy We Built a Nation. I've listened to that one episode 3 times just to try to wrap my head around how we got here. So listen to the Seeing White podcast. It'll blow your mind and hopefully humble all of us in the face of all that needs to be learned and unlearned. So, Seeing White, that's my endorsement.
You know, one thing about this show is I never hesitate to steal ideas. Even the idea of endorsements is an idea I stole from Slate Culture Gabfest. As long as you acknowledge it, you know, from time to time, you can steal things. So I'll tell you an idea that I'm going to steal that sort of I can incorporate into an endorsement. So I was just at this public radio program directors convention, and the smartest guy in public radio, I think, is this guy, John Barth. By smartest, I mean he thinks the most closely to the way I think. That's how I judge whether someone is smart or not. But anyway, I asked him, well, what's a really good podcast? He told me he said, Everything is Alive. That's all he said, but which I assumed was probably the name of a podcast. And I was correct. So Everything Alive is a podcast where they where one person interviews an inanimate object, which is played by a voice actor. The episode you're going to listen to is the one featuring Dennis the pillow. So it's a pillow named Dennis. He talks about what it's like to be a pillow. And I'm stealing this idea once because Jonathan McPans has somewhere in our pipeline a show about towels coming up, and I just totally want to interview a towel as part of that show. Anyway, I will just wrap up by saying yes, I've been in Austin for all of the preceding days of this week. Got home last night. We were there. Katie Tularski, Beth Messina, and I were all there. We've come home with a big grab bag of ideas. I'm always looking for ways to tweak and mess around with our show episodes. So we're going to keep the nose off the air for at least one more week while we think a little bit more about anything we might like to change. If you have ideas about things that you'd like us to change or new things you want us to try, you can email me, Colin, just my first name, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Thanks to everybody who came out to work on this lovely day, and thanks to all of you who are listening right now.